It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the program, we'll learn why Sheboygan is known to many as the Malibu of the Midwest.
First, we're taking a look at the year so far in science. It may only be the end of April, but 2014 has already seen some pretty amazing scientific breakthroughs. We have Gemma Tarlak with us now to talk about some of those stories. She's a senior associate editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. Gemma, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, always good to be here with you guys.
So you're starting us off with a super cool story about a dinosaur, one that's related to a T-Rex, no less, only this is sort of a T-Rex mini. What do we know about this new discovery?
Well, I like to think of Nanoxaurus hoglandae as the hobbit of T-Rexes, really. We're not sure about that, but the animal was about half the size of your average T-Rex. And the really cool thing to me is that he was found several hundred miles above the Arctic Circle. So he was an Arctic dinosaur. And, you know, I don't know about you, I love dinosaurs, but still when I think about them, I think about them in deciduous forests, in savannas, in swamps. You know, you don't think about an Arctic dinosaur, but here he is. He was likely the apex predator. And Nanoxaurus hoglandae is probably too much of a mouthful, so I like to call him Polar Bearsaurus. And the cool thing is he was about half the size of the average T-Rex, and they're not sure why that is. But I was talking to the researchers, actually, about a week ago about this story, and they were telling me it almost didn't happen. They were up in the Arctic looking for a completely different dinosaur that they had found kind of bits and pieces of earlier, and they saw these kind of cool-looking rocks near where they were digging and thought, well, we'll put those on the helicopter, too. And forward a few years, they took a closer look at those cool-looking rocks and realized, oh my gosh, we have found the first Arctic apex predator. So it's a very cool story, how it happened, and also what we now know about T-Rexes in the Arctic.
What do we know about the Arctic at the time that this mini T-Rex was there, though? Was it a little warmer, say, than today?
Oh, it was a lot warmer, and we're talking about 70 million years ago. And it was not a desert or anything, but the researchers actually compared it to, say, Portland, Oregon today, or Vancouver. It was pretty moist, and it was fairly temperate. However, it still, because it was up at the pole, had those extreme seasonal changes. And they think, actually, that might be why the tiny T-Rex was so tiny, that he didn't have access to the same amount of resources throughout the year, that his prey probably diminished during the cold months, or the colder months, but more importantly, the darker months. There's no evidence in the bones that they have, the skulls, jaw, and teeth. There's no evidence that he had adapted to 6 months of darkness or near darkness. So it's possible that, you know, he went a few months hungry just because he couldn't find his prey because it was so dark.
Wow.
He didn't have a flashlight. Very sad.
So what does the discovery of this little hobbit T-Rex tell us about the lineage of these, alpha predators like the Tyrannosaurus?
Well, it opens up a whole new family within the T-Rex family. It opens up a whole new group. And also, it really kind of turns on its head the idea of the diversity and adaptability in the Tyrannosaurid line. When most of us think about T-Rexes, we think about them roaming around someplace like, an island off Costa Rica, right? Like in Jurassic Park. But they're suddenly way more diverse and way more adaptable than anyone thought. And at the same time, it also tells us a lot about the ecology of the Arctic during that period, 70 million years ago, because, you know, it's hard to get a handle on ecology from plant fossils and such. There's very little of that left around. But when you start to build the actual food chain of that time, you can start to understand what it must have been like, what the environment must have been like, who was eating who, so to speak. And it's allowing them to build a much fuller picture of a time and place we really don't know that much about.
It seems like every time I go to a natural history museum, there's more new dinosaurs, more diversity. Is there an explosion of discoveries in the dinosaur world in the last couple decades?
Well, I think it's something that, in a lot of cases, they're actually going back and looking at fossils that were found years, even a century or so ago, and knowing what we now know about dinosaurs, looking at them and thinking, let's relook at this one. So they're finding new species that way. But there's also a much broader area of exploration. You know, when you think about it, a century ago, Roald Amundsen and Robert F. Scott were just getting to the South Pole for the first time. Now we've got people down there living year-round, and we have actually paleontologists digging up dinosaurs in Antarctica. That was a place we never went before. So I think that is part of the explosion as well. But it is a great time to be a dinosaur fan, I have to say.
So I got to ask you, Gemma, our producer Chris wants to know this very important question. Did this little hobbit T-Rex still have the little tiny arms? Or at least, I guess they'd be even tinier.
Well, they were so tiny he couldn't work the flashlight, and that's why he couldn't find his prey in the darkness. No. Well, we're not sure because they didn't find the whole skeleton,
okay. But
just based on what they did find, it's pretty sure they can work up the model based on what they do have. And yeah, he had those tiny arms. No.
Good.
Decorating the Christmas tree for him. So sad.
Well, let's stay in the arm region, but this time I will move to humans. Another story you wanted to highlight is one of the most exciting things so far this year, a new kind of prosthetic hand. What's special about this invention?
Well, this was a test they did in Europe earlier this year, and this is the first time ever that they have been able to have real-time touch sensation. And they tested it in a Danish man who had lost his hand about 10 years ago, I think in a motorcycle accident. And when you look at the thing online or in print, it's this big, bulky contraption. But what they did was install super-sensitive sensors in the prosthetic fingers, and they measure these minute changes in the positions of the artificial tendons. Because, you know, when you think about when you grab something or touch something, your hand is not really static. Your hand runs over the surface, feels it, decides how much pressure to apply to pick it up. And when your hand is doing that, naturally, your tendons are making tiny little changes. So these sensors measured those tiny little changes in the artificial tendons, and then they translated those measurements into electrical signals that were understood by the human nervous system, and the signals were transmitted into the actual wearer of the hand, of the prosthetic hand, via electrodes that were implanted in the remaining nerves in his arm right above the amputation site. So through this complicated little highway, they were able to, you know, he could experience whether he was holding a baseball or an orange or kind of a wad of cotton gauze or a hard brick-like thing. And when you think about it, okay, maybe that doesn't sound so exciting, but it is really exciting because of what it will lead to. And that could be, you know, in a few years. I mean, we're still a ways away, but in a few years, we could have artificial limbs where the wearers could feel sensations of temperature or texture or much finer gradations of the real-time sensation of what am I picking up, how hard should I hold it, et cetera. So it's really exciting.
Well, we're talking right now to Discover Magazine editor Gemma Tarlak about some of the biggest science stories of 2014 so far. Coming up, we'll learn about how the genetic sequencing of an infant tells a story about how people first arrived in North America. We're continuing our conversation with Discover Magazine editor Gemma Tarlak now. We're talking about the biggest stories in science so far in 2014. And Gemma, another story, this one seems to have pretty huge implications, is the genome sequencing of the earliest known human remains in North America. So what was discovered? Who did we find?
We found a little baby, probably 18 to 24 months old. A male infant, and they've named him Anzac 1 regarding the property was found. It was the Anzac family property. He was actually found in 1968, and he is about 12,000 years old, 12,600 years old. So his remains were found on this ranch in western Montana. And even in 1968, when the remains were first found, they knew they were significant for a couple reasons. He is the only burial associated with the Clovis culture. And, you know, folks in Madison may be very familiar with Clovis culture because a lot of researchers have been based in Madison over the years. But it's basically the first homegrown American culture that we know of. It started about 13,000 years ago. And it's called, it's identified with very specifically shaped spear points and other tools. So that's how it's identified. But he is the only person we have whose burial site we can definitively say is associated with the Clovis culture. And that's because he was found with more than 100 Clovis artifacts covered in red ochre buried at this site in Montana. So even when he was first found decades ago, they knew it was going to be a big deal. But the family wasn't sure what to do, and so for years the remains were actually kept in a secure place, And they turned down requests from scientists over the years to study the remains more closely because they were very concerned about being sensitive to, you know, the cultural issues. Native Americans feel very strongly about how their ancestors should be treated, and they didn't want to offend anyone. So for years, they turned down research requests. Finally, a couple years ago, a Danish researcher approached them and said he not only wanted to sequence the genome of the child's remains, but that he wanted to do it in a very culturally sensitive way. And even before they did any science, the research team met with a number of tribal leaders throughout the Montana area, talked to them about what they were going to do, was it okay to do it, and they got their approval. And that's actually one of the reasons why this is such a big deal. It represents kind of a new chapter in the relationships between researchers and Native Americans, because there's been a lot of disagreement and a lot of very bitter legal wrangling over who has the right to the remains, what should be done with them. So that's one reason it was a big deal. But another huge reason, when they got the results back, you know, I talked to the researcher about a week ago, and he was shocked when they got the results back because they proved without a doubt that this boy's family, his, you know, extended family, the people in and around where he lived, they are the direct ancestors to 80% of Native people in the Americas. That's
wow.
From Alaska down to the south tip of South America.
And Gemma, so, I want to jump in and put this in a little context. This is a long-running debate question in archaeology, human biology. The people who populated the New World, where did they come from? When did they come here, right?
Yeah. So, but he did show they were direct ancestors to 80% and close cousins to the other 20%. And this is really important, again, because of the Clovis connection. There have been a few different theories about how the first people arrived to the Americas, but one of the theories is called the Solutrean hypothesis, and it found alleged parallels in Clovis tools with tools from sites in southwestern Europe. And in the Solutrean hypothesis, researchers, some of them very prominent, were saying, well, the first people to the Americas actually came by following the edge of the ice during the last ice age over from Europe. So the first Americans were actually Europeans. And that's been very controversial and it's very contested, but this proves that that actually wasn't the case because the people using and making Clovis tools in the Americas were definitely coming over from Siberia, and that they were the people who went on to be the ancestors of Native Americans. It's pretty irrefutable evidence.
So what kind of aftershocks is this news getting in scientific communities, since it seems to put to bed one of the competing theories about how people got to North America?
It does, and there's a lot of kind of grumbling and, well, maybe, you know, maybe this, maybe that, but I think people are really accepting. Certainly people associated with the research were shocked. They weren't expecting such definitive results. And because the results are definitive, I think people are coming around to it. And it also, there are other alternative theories. There are alleged human settlement sites that are 40,000 years old in Peru and Brazil. And this actually, ANSIC 1's genome shows that those sites are not human settlements. They're probably just geofacts, which is naturally weathered rocks and stuff that make it look like humans may have been there. But there's no way that you could have had humans that far south in the Americas 40,000 years ago. If that had been the case, you would actually see genetic drift between ANSIC 1's genome and the genes of people in Brazil and Peru today. And you don't see that difference. So they think the first Americans came over the Bering Sea land bridge about 15,000 years ago. And ANSIC 1's gene proves that. But, you know, culturally and legally, there are also some ramifications. There are human remains found 9,000 years old in Washington State that have been sitting in a museum not on display for two decades just because scientists and the local tribes are suing and counter-suing each other over who has the right to decide what to do with the remains.
And so I want to ask you about ANSIC 1. You said this was a controversial thing and that it took a lot of careful negotiations about how the remains were to be treated before the genome could be sequenced. So where are those remains now? Now that the sequencing has been done, what happened to that infant?
Well, it's kind of a really interesting footnote. The researchers, after consulting with the local tribal communities, they will be reburying the remains later this year back where the child was found. And, you know, I asked them when I said, how do you feel about this? And both of the researchers I talked to said, at the beginning of this project, I was opposed to it. I hate to see something that scientifically significant going back into the ground. But now that I understand the full context, now that from the results, we know that this child is directly ancestral to the people, they should be the ones to decide what to do with the remains. And it's kind of a fascinating, fascinating story.
Well, Gemma, thanks so much for being with us again today.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
That was Gemma Tarlak, regular guest here on Central Time, also senior associate editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha, sharing some of the biggest stories in science so far in 2014.
When most of us think of surfing, we probably don't think about Wisconsin, but believe it or not, Sheboygan is Wisconsin's very own Malibu. Commentator Bill Polevit tells the story of surfing the Great Lakes.
I first heard rumors of a hardy band of Lake Michigan surfers who transformed Sheboygan into the Malibu of the Midwest back in the late 1980s. I grew up just 30 miles south of these guys in the Milwaukee suburb of Mequon. Lake Michigan was in my backyard. Every morning over a bowl of cereal, I'd gaze through my living room window at the Great Lake, but not once did I ever say to myself, "Look at those waves! I'm gonna ride them with a surfboard!" Like most Wisconsinites, I never once considered surfing as a local form of recreation, even on the muggiest summer afternoons. Then I moved to California. When lifelong surfers from Malibu, Huntington Beach, San Onofre, and San Diego discovered that I was from Wisconsin, they couldn't contain their excitement. Sheboygan was on their bucket list of places to surf. Intrigued, I knew I had to meet these unlikely Midwestern surfers. Twin brothers Lee Waterfleet and Larry Longboard Williams had dreamed of surfing the world-famous waves of Hawaii, Australia, and California since they were 13 years old. But their reality was Sheboygan, nearly 1,000 miles from either coast. So they brought surfing to Sheboygan. They began surfing Lake Michigan in 1967, and in 1988, they founded the Dairyland Surf Classic. Every Labor Day weekend, surfers from around the world converge on the town. As crazy as it sounds, surfing on the Great Lakes isn't new. It's believed the Great Lakes began hosting surfers nearly 5,000 years ago when Native Americans first developed dugout canoes. Although very little is known about these early Wisconsin residents, there's plenty of circumstantial evidence to support their potential passion for wave riding, much like the ancient Hawaiians. Sheboygan's modern surfing era actually began in 1962, when some local teenagers saw what was happening in Southern California and wondered, why can't we surf here? Sheboygan's ideal surf season is during the fall and winter, when friction created from cold air traveling across the warm water of Lake Michigan creates a wind swell. Because the region juts 5 miles out into Lake Michigan, the city gets winds from most directions, creating the most surfable waves on the lake. The harshest weather conditions also create the best waves, sometimes more than 12 feet tall. The violent weather systems required for good surfing conditions on the lake also make the sport risky. Riptides, wind, and cold are just some of the dangers. Icebergs and hypothermia, not sharks, are a Sheboygan surfer's most treacherous adversaries. When Lee and Larry founded the Dairyland Surf Classic, they had no idea that their passion for the sport would help redefine the nation's bratwurst capital into the Malibu of the Midwest. Even today, most of Sheboygan's 50,000 residents are unaware of their community's growing popularity as a surfing destination. But it's well known among surfers who say you haven't surfed every corner of the planet until you've surfed Sheboygan.
That was commentator Bill Pavletic. Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. Catch more Wisconsin Life on Wisconsin Public Television Monday nights at 8 p.m. You can find more info at wisconsinlife.org.
Now we have Great Lakes surfing pioneer Larry Longboard Williams with us to talk more about surfing culture in Sheboygan. Larry, welcome to Central Time.
Aloha.
Well, aloha back to you. So surfing culture in Wisconsin, that's something that's new to a lot of us. What makes surfing in Sheboygan so special?
Well, it's kind of funny when you mention surfing to anyone who's not familiar with it here in the Great Lakes, and especially here in Sheboygan. They say, well, that's windsurfing. We love to watch them windsurfing. No, it's not windsurfing. Well, it's them, those kites, right? We go, no. This is like Moondoggy and Gidget. You go, really? You have waves? And what it is, it's the topography and the location of Sheboygan here on the Great Lakes. We need a low pressure, which brings winds. We're in the prevailing westerlies, so it turns the winds around. So it brings the winds onshore instead of offshore. So it brings our waves onto our shore. But we're centrally located here on Lake Michigan, right in the middle of the western shore of one-fifth of the world's fresh water, the five Great Lakes. And because we're centrally located, we get waves from any direction onshore, north, northeast, south or southeast, or even east winds, bring in quality, rideable waves. Now, when you talk about a lake, you think about pine trees and log cabins and cottages and fishing off a little wooden pier. That's not Lake Michigan. Lake Michigan is 22,440 square miles of open water. It's 310 miles long and 110 miles across. It's not a lake. It's an inland ocean. And on any given day, you can stand on our shore and watch ocean-going vessels go by. And then we wait for the storms that whip up winds of 20 to 25 miles an hour or more to produce rideable waves.
Well, I imagine a question you probably get from surfers in warmer places. I gather surf season is in the cold water months sometimes. What kind of, how do you stay warm in cold, cold Lake Michigan?
Well, if you want to stay out for any length of time anywhere on the Great Lakes, you're wearing a wetsuit and with the addition of boots and gloves. And so for many of us, we have two or three different wetsuits depending upon the cold. And, you know, some of our suits at 33-degree water temperature, 24 below wind chills, you know, we could stay out for 3 hours comfortably.
Wow. Well, I have to tell you, Larry, I'm going to confess, one of my dreams is to one day try to surf. I never thought I'd try to do it in Lake Michigan. That just seems crazy. But for those of us who've never surfed before, what does it feel like to surf a wave on Lake Michigan?
Well, the Beach Boys had it right when they said, catch a wave and you're sitting on top of the world. You try it one time and you are certainly hooked. You paddle out as hard as you can, sometimes on the biggest days, over a half mile, three quarters of a mile out. And every wave that hits you tries to put you back on the beach. And you work like the dickens to get way out past the biggest breakers. And you get out there, you're so winded, you just can't believe you made it out there. If somebody started your hair on fire, you wouldn't be able to put your arms over your head to put it out. And then you look, and these surfers are skidding past you, gliding on these fiberglass airplane wings, and you turn around and catch your first wave. And waves are traveling anywhere from 12 to even 15 miles an hour in, but you combine that with a free fall drop. That the G-force factor is phenomenal, that you do these big arcing turns, and you've got this liquid beast that's trying to eat you as you're propelling forward on these fiberglass rockets at what seems to be like 90 miles an hour. And you try to perform all these maneuvers without thinking about them. If you think too hard, you wipe out, and you get gobbled and sent to the bottom. And you finally make it to shore, and you stand there, and you actually put your hand on your neoprene chest to feel your heart almost pounding through that rubber.
Wow, sounds pretty spectacular.
And you think, I'm just going to stand here for a few minutes and think about what I just did. But then you look out and you realize, heck, I could be missing even better waves. So you paddle out and start all over again.
Can you ride the pipe or the tube like you can on the ocean where you're literally encased in a tube of water?
Absolutely. We've got, because this place is so diverse for surfing and such a rich history, we've got a place called North Point that has been referred to as the Mount Everest of freshwater surfing. We've also got a reef 1 mile out that in the movie Step Into Liquid, you could hear me say the line, "We've got barrels so big you could hide a Volkswagen in them." It's just like Banzai Pipeline, North Shore of Oahu, Hawaiian Island.
Now, you've said, I gather, surfing is more than a sport. It's a lifestyle. Why is that?
Oh, and it certainly is. It's the vehicle you drive to put these 10, 11-foot-long surfboards in or on. It's the terrible colored shirts we have to wear, and it's the living life and raising your children on the beach so you can enjoy your passion. It's the way we decorate our homes. It's the food we eat so we can endure this cold water and these long paddle outs. Heck, we even have our own music. Golf doesn't have their own music. Fishing doesn't even have their own music. But we've got our own music. And it's not, we think of it less as a sport as it is a lifestyle. We've got our own language. And it's just a cool place to be. And especially the 47 years that my twin brother and I have been doing this, it's our passion, and it's the vacations we take and the way we live our lives.
And Larry, in our last minute here, how would you say surfing culture has changed in Sheboygan over the years?
Well, it's amazing. We had old scuba suits that didn't fit real well. We didn't have ankle leashes that are safety factors now that tether us to our boards. The boards that were 45 pounds years ago now weigh 8 pounds. We have wetsuits that are very flexible and keep us so warm. But we have this whole culture of these so many people traveling in. Hawaiians leave Hawaii to come surf Sheboygan. Californians and everyone come to our uncrowded freshwater waves. We've never had a shark attack. And what it is, it's this great aloha spirit, this family sharing, this extended family that the Hawaiians call ohana, that is so rich here in our traditional Midwest values that brings people to the jewel of Sheboygan.
Well, Larry, thank you so much for joining us. It's fantastic to hear about. Appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate it too. Aloha.
Aloha to you. That was Larry Longboard Williams, Great Lakes surfing pioneer.